All right, good evening, everyone. So tonight we're going to focus, of course, this is a parsha shir, so we focus on the parsha, but what I'd like to really draw your attention to this particular week is actually the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer. And not as much the counting of the Omer, but certain aspects of the Omer which we're going to dwell on tonight. I feel it's justifiable, A, because it's the Omer, that's number one. And number two, of course, in Parshas Omer is contained the mitzvah of Usartam Lachem, of actually going in and counting the Omer. So this is going to be the fulcrum of our focus tonight. Our shir tonight is dedicated in memory of Harav Baruch Ben Yosef HaKohen Zichronu Livracha and Rivka Bas Dov Nosan Aleha HaShalom by Rabbi and Mrs. Bernard Greenfield, by their children Rabbi and Mrs. Yossi Greenfield. And we hope that in the merit of our communal Talmud Torah, their neshamas have an aliyah. All right, so let's begin. Just making sure everything is working online here. Okay, good. Let's begin. Number one, the Shulchan Aruch writes, "Noagim shlovisa isha bein Pesach la'atzeres." The minhag is that we don't get married in between Shavuos, in between Pesach and Shavuos. The Shulchan Aruch number two writes, "Noagim shlovisa staper." The minhag is that we don't take a haircut. Interestingly enough, different communities had different customs. Some communities didn't take a haircut and didn't shave. Some communities just didn't take a haircut but did shave. Some communities never adopted these customs altogether. But again, for now, we'll just go with the just basic psak of the Shulchan Aruch, which is there's a custom to refrain from haircutting over the course of this time between Pesach and Shavuos. Number three, the Shulchan Aruch writes, here I'm quoting from the Ramah. Remember, as I mentioned a number of different times, the Shulchan Aruch is written by Rav Yosef Karo. Rav Yosef Karo was a Sephardic posek who lived in the 1500s. So Rav Yosef Karo does something absolutely amazing for Sephardic Jewry. He condenses all of halacha into a simple, well, nothing simple, but, into an organized digest, which was wonderful, except it left us Ashkenazim feeling out a little bit in the cold. We wanted a digest of our own. So in the 1600s, a man by the name of Rav Moshe Isserles went through the Shulchan, from Krakow, Poland, went through the Shulchan Aruch, and interestingly enough, kind of like, I mentioned in the Pirkei Avashir a couple of weeks ago, when we think of Hillel and Shammai, we think of Machlokes. But of course, in reality, how many times did Hillel and Shammai disagree? In how many areas? Three times. Three areas in Halacha, that's all. Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, their students had many more Machloksim, but Shammai and Hillel themselves, only three. So Sfardim and Ashkenazim are much more alike than dissimilar. So what, amazing, right? So what the Shulchan Aruch, what Ramah did is he went through the Shulchan Aruch, and essentially whenever Sfardic and Ashkenazic practice are the same, he doesn't say anything. Wherever there's a departure, he puts in what's called a Hagah, a footnote. A footnote. So when you learn Shulchan Aruch, you'll see there's a Hagah. It's usually written like in Rashi script, as opposed to the Mechaber that's written in block letters. And that's the Ramah. So number three, the Ramah comments, Ela mistaprim biyom lamed gimel. So although in number two, the Shulchan Aruch says that we don't go ahead and take a haircut in between Pesach and Shavuos, the Ramah comes along and says, well, let me clarify that just a little bit. Ela mistaprim biyom lamed gimel. We do in fact go ahead and take a haircut on Lag BaOmer. Umar bim bo kitzas simcha. And we actually have a little bit of simcha, a little bit of enjoyment, a little bit of happiness on this day. Ve'ein omrim bo tachnun. And we don't recite tachnun as part of our plays. Remember, tachnun is a supplicatory prayer. Vayomer David al God, tsar li ma'od. Tachnun is a prayer that speaks about suffering, that speaks about difficulties. That's why on any day where there is a, we'll call it the thematic overtone of simcha, even if it's not so much simcha, we automatically, immediately omit tachnun. So the Ramah says that although, again, in numbers 1 and 2, the Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber, treats the period between Pesach and Shavuos as one solid period, the Ramah says, no, there's a break in the middle, there's Lag BaOmer, where we take a haircut, we get married, and and we have a certain degree of, bless you, of amplified celebration. So what I'd like to focus on tonight is two fundamental questions. Number one, what is the nature of the mourning of Sfira? M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. What is the nature of the avelus, of the mourning? Clearly, you have to understand something. When Halacha tells you not to get married, that's a very serious thing. Why? Why? Because Judaism has an incredible fixation on continuity. And continuity is established by creating families. So the idea that the halacha would tell you don't get married is very dramatic. Very dramatic. There's another thing the halacha is very careful with, which is one's personal grooming habits. Right? Again, as a Jew, we always have to be very careful how we present ourselves, because ultimately we are the ambassadors of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So for the halacha to essentially say, let yourself go a little bit, is a very dramatic thing as well. So question number one is, what are we mourning? That's number one. But the real question is, what is it that we are supposed to accomplish through this mourning? Because it's very important to understand that in halacha, or in Judaism, mourning is never an ends, it's always a means. For example, take a look at number four. I actually quoted part of this in the Tehillim Shir this morning. The Geshar Chaim, written by Rav Tukhachinsky. So Rav Tukhachinsky writes, "Acharei shemiyisod ha'emuna shakol ba'ashkacha betzedek uvechesed v'chayiv levarich al ha'ra'a halot tzrichim lahavin mitzvas ha'avelos mai." So the Geshar Chaim asks such a fundamental yet simple question. He says, if we believe, which we do, that everything is the will of God, and we also believe that when a person leaves this world, we believe that the neshama goes to a much better place called Olam Haba. So the Geshar Chaim asks a fascinating question. So what should we do away with? Mourning. Then why do we have alelos? Then why do we mourn? Then why do we shut ourselves off from the world for 7 days and wallow and lose ourselves and envelop ourselves in our loss? Everything that God does is good. The neshama of my loved one is in so much of, we're not in a rush to get there. But once our number is called, it's an incredible place to be by the Kisya Kavod. So what are we mourning? So the Geshar Chaim gives two answers. Simple answer, he says, is because we're human beings. We're people. Why are you asking me why I'm mourning? So you're asking me why I feel pain when I lose someone who I love? The answer is because I'm human. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if you have a kasha on that, well, I have news for you. You created me like that. Right? So you created me with the capacity to feel, the capacity to form relationships, and therefore when that relationship is severed through death, I feel pain. And as such, I mourn my pain. I'm not really mourning for the person who's gone. I'm not mourning for the person who's no longer here. I believe that person is in a better... I mourn for me. Because I'm the one left behind. But then he goes on and he says something dramatic. If you take a look at the last two lines, he says, "Hula hashrish chashivus chaye ha'adam." This is fascinating. He says, you know why we mourn? We mourn, there's a line I often like to use. Because too often, says the Geshar Chaim, we go through life assuming that life is an infinite renewable resource. Says the Geshar Chaim, not true. Life is a finite, non-renewable resource. So you know why we have Avelos as the Geshar Chaim? Because Avelos reminds us, and remember, Avelos is not just about the Avel. Who does Avelos also bring into the picture? The community. Right? The community has to come to the house of the Avel to daven. The community is supposed to take care of the meals for the Avel. The community has to go visit the Avel. So the mitzvah of Avelos, says the Geshar Chaim, is not just about the Avel. It's about the community. And why is it there? To remind us that life is a finite, non-renewable resource. To remind us that one day we too will leave this world. And as such, it's an amazing idea, we mourn in order to reinvigorate ourselves to live. Because all too often, we just assume that, okay, there'll be tomorrow, there'll be next week, there'll be next year, and we all know, because we all do it, some of us in more profound ways, others in less pronounced ways, we push things off. There are things we know we have to do in life. Major. I'm not talking about going to 7 Mile Market. That's important also. I'm talking about major life things that we know we need to do. But there's not enough time. Not enough time when I retire, or when this, or when I have this, or when I've reached this. And we set all these benchmarks for accomplishment. The Geshar Chaim says, probably not a good idea. Why? Because we know not how long HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us in this world. So we see that even the act of mourning for a loved one, even avelos, the goal is not mourning. The goal is to use mourning as a springboard for living. Similarly, if you take a look at number five, I'm just giving you examples in halacha of where you see that mourning is not an ends, but mourning is a means. If you take a look at number five, so the Gemara, and Meseches Tainus says, "Mikan amru, kol amis avel al Yerushalayim zocha v'ra b'simchaso. Whoever mourns for Jerusalem will have the privilege to see in its joy and jubilation. Meaning whoever mourns for the absence of Yerushalayim will have the privilege to see it rebuilt. V'she'eino mis'avel al Yerushalayim, and whoever does not mourn for Jerusalem, eino ro'a b'simchasa, will not be privileged to share or to see its joy. So what is the Gemara saying over here? Something absolutely amazing. Why do we mourn for Yerushalayim? Why do we do so many different things, zecher lemikdash? We do things in our home, we behave different ways every single day in davening, we say with Yerushalayim, ircha baracha nim toshuv. Why? Why? Mourning is not, and you know why we mourn? We mourn to awaken within ourselves an eager anticipation for redemption. We mourn because by mourning, what I remind myself is there's more to come. And you know, in life, when there's something exciting that's going to come to you, what do? You can't wait for it. You can't. You're supposed to become impatient. So I mourn for Yerushalayim because mourning for Yerushalayim reminds me that life is going to become so much more. That there's so much more still that's going to occur for us. So we mourn to stoke the fires of eager anticipation for the geula that is sure to come. Seth, can you just take out a few more chairs just from this closet right over here? Thank you. So I'm just showing you over here that therefore you see that mourning is not an ends, but rather mourning is a means. And then now we have to fine-tune our question a little bit more, which is if we're mourning on Sfira, thank you, if we're mourning on Sfira Sa'omer, then the question becomes what? Right? The question becomes what? What are we doing? What is it that we are... Not just simply a question. First part of the question is, what are we mourning for? And the second part of the question is, what are we supposed to gain and glean from this particular experience? So I put an approach on here, which we're not going to do tonight. Is actually, we covered it over the last days of Pesach, but you can look at it on your own. Rav Soloveitchik has a fascinating insight, but not for tonight. Instead, what I want to focus you on is number 7. We're going to read now a Gemara with which you are all familiar with. Disanya, Rabbi Yeshua says, Nasa Adam Isha Bialduso, if a person married in his youth, Yisa Isha Biziknuso, he should get married in his older age as well. So what this sounds like over here is, let's say a person was married in Chas V'Shalom, a person lost their spouse or something else happened that fractured, that tore apart the relationship. So a person should not despair, a person should go ahead and remarry again. If a person had children in their young... There are chairs over here. If a person had children in their youth, they should have children in their old age as well. I think this was before yeshiva tuition. But okay. The Pasuk in Kohelet says, and again, I quote a few of the Pasuk in number 8. Here, just skip down to 8 for just a moment. This is the Pasuk in Kohelet that we're quoting. Baboker zora ezarecha, in the morning, sow your seeds. Ula erev al tanech yadecha. But in the evening, do not withdraw your hands. Even though you've planted in the morning, don't stop planting in the evening as well. Why? Shalom Aleph says, I'm reading the whole pasuk now, number 8. Ki eincho yodea eiza yikasher. Because at the end of the day, you don't know which of your efforts will materialize. You don't know at the end of the day what's going to endure. Ozeh, hazeh, ozeh. Will it be the planting of the morning, or will it be the planting of the evening? V'im shnehem ke'echad. Shlomo Melech writes, and you know what? If you're one of those lucky people, that what you plant in the morning sprouts, and what you plant in the evening sprouts, tovin. How fortunate you are. So go back up to number 7. So now we have Rabbi Yoshua saying that even if you had children in your youth, have children in your older age. Even if you married in your youth, marry again in your older age. Why? Because Shlomo Melech says, even if you planted your seeds in the morning, don't withdraw your hand in the evening, for we know not which efforts ultimately endure and which efforts actualize. So the Gemara goes on. Rabbi Kiva Omer, Rabbi Kiva says, Lamat Torah Bialduso. I'm back up in number 7, 3 lines in. Lamat Torah Bialduso. If a person learned Torah in his youth, Yilmot Torah Biziknuso. He shall learn Torah in his old age. Hayulot Hamidim Bialduso. If you had students in your youth, you established students, Yihilot Hamidim Biziknuso. You should establish students in your old age as well. Shene Emar, Baboker, Zara es Zarecha. And Rabbi Akiva quotes the same exact pasuk. Now, what's the question? There's a very simple question, which is, Rabbi Akiva, what are you adding? Right? Remember, what's the theme of the Gemara? What's the theme? Right? What's the theme? That no matter, even if you've done a lot in your youth, make sure to continue to do in your advanced years as well. I'm not going to define advanced years. Everybody will define it for themselves, right? But whatever you've done earlier in life, make sure to continue later on in life as well. So we got it. We got it. So here Rabbi Yehoshua demonstrates it by marrying, having children. Rabbi Akiva comes on and says, oh yeah, and if you learn Torah in your youth, learn Torah in your old age. And if you had students in your youth, establish students in your old age. So before we go on, the fundamental question is, Rabbi Akiva, I understand. I don't need another example of the same principle. You're just giving me another example of the principle stated by Rabbi Yehoshua. I got it. Obviously, if Rabbi Akiva is coming along and needing to add in, you'll excuse me, his two cents, it's clear that there's something much more dramatic unfolding over here. And the Gemara picks up on this. Because the Gemara is bothered by this, saying, Rabbi Akiva, why are you weighing in on this if you are not introducing any new information? The Gemara answers, because whereas Rabbi Yehoshua is making a statement, Rabbi Akiva lived this statement. The Gemara goes on. Amru, because they said, 12,000 zugim talmidim hayu lo Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students, 24,000 students. Mikvas ad Antipras, from one end of Eretz Yisrael all the way to the other end of Eretz Yisrael. And what happened? V'kulan meisu b'perek echad. And they all died at the same time. Perek echad means in one period of time. Why? Because they did not give honor one to the other. And the world was desolate. When it says the world was desolate, it means that the death of the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva represents an existential threat to the Jewish people. The students of Rabbi Akiva are the future Manhige Yisrael. They are the future leaders. What do you do when leadership is wiped out? There was an existential threat to Judaism. Maybe the Masorah is simply not going to continue. What happened? Rabbi Akiva went to some of the rabbis in the south, and he taught them. And who were the rabbis that he taught? Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. These five were his new talmidim. Veheim heim ha'emidu Torah osa shah. And these rabbis were the ones who sustained the Masorah. They sustained the Jewish tradition, and they rebuilt all that Rabbi Akiva had lost. Tana, the Gemara says, kulam mesu mi Pesach va'ad atzeres. And when did Rabbi Akiva's students die? They died in the period between Pesach and atzeres. So generally, when we look at this Gemara, the focus is almost always on the idea of Mipnei Shelo Nahagu Kavod Zelazeh, right? Because it's a strange Gemara. Here you have 24,000 Talmidei Chachamim. Granted, Lo Nahagu Kavod Zelazeh, they didn't give cover to each other. So number one, no, it's not good. It's not good, but it doesn't seem to warrant a death penalty. So of course, that leaves us with the question of what does it really mean? We're not focusing on this tonight. Tonight, we're not focusing on the cause of the death. Instead, tonight, I want to draw your attention to a question which I have to tell you, I never thought about it until this year. This is the first year looking at this Gemara that it dawned on me. And there's something profoundly fundamental that's missing from the Gemara. And it's what? What was Rabbi Akiva's reaction to the death of his 24,000 students? The Gemara tells a narrative. Rabbi Akiva lost 24,000 students. It was an existential threat, but he got five new Talmidim and they reestablished Torah. Okay. Rabbi Akiva, what did you say? What was the drasha that Shabbos? Like, what did you tell the Olam? What was your response when 24,000 of the best and brightest of Klal Yisrael clearly fell at the hand of God? Unless you think that Rabbi Akiva didn't have a response, I'll tell you why I can't believe that. We're familiar with the Gemara Maseches Brachos. I didn't put it on your sheet. Maybe I should have. But the Gemara Maseches Brachos is in Daf Samech Aleph Amud Beis, 61b, excuse me. And that's the famous Gemara. We know that Rabbi Akiva was one of the Asara Harugei Malchus. He was one of the 10 martyrs who was killed under Hadrianic persecution. And the Gemara details that they're in a brutal, horrific death, that literally they're flaying Rabbi Akiva's flesh off his body. And what is Rabbi Akiva doing at that moment? Rabbi Akiva is saying Shema. And it's a dramatic exchange where the students say, Rebbe, really, Ad Kan, do you have to go so far? And Rabbi Akiva says, all my life I always wondered, the Torah says, V'yahavtas Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavecha b'chol nafshecha b'chol maldecha, to love God with all of your heart, all of your soul. And Rabbi Akiva said, and I always wondered, Ad Masai, when will this opportunity come my way? V'achshav shebo liyodiv lo akayimena, and now I have the opportunity to do it and I shouldn't fulfill it. So Rabbi Akiva is the one. There's another episode. Last Gemara Maseches Makos. Remember that story where the rabbis are walking by the ruins of the Beis HaMikdash? And there's a whole group of rabbis. The rabbis begin to cry. Rabbi Akiva begins to laugh. Make a long story short, Rabbi Akiva has the ability to be able to bring in a different perspective, even on tragedy, even on difficulty. Rabbi Akiva is never at a loss for words. And I take even a step further. Not only is Rabbi Akiva never at a loss for words, Rabbi Akiva is the king of perspective. Rabbi Akiva is the king of the ability to see a situation dramatically, almost optimistically different than anyone else. So it bothered me. I'm going to be honest with you. It really bothered me that the Gemara doesn't record a response by Rabbi Akiva. Your Talmidim died. And you understand, when 24,000 Talmidim die, it's not just 24,000 Talmidim die. This is not an elementary school, right? These are future Rabbanim, which means that there are 24,000 families, right? There are 24,000 widows. There are 24,000 families of children without a father. This is not just a Torah tragedy. This is a Klal Yisrael tragedy. This is a tragedy of epic proportions. And not a word. Nothing. And so I think we have to explore this a little bit. Why is there no recorded response by Rabbi Akiva? So I want to show you a couple of different ideas. Take a look at number 9. So this is an episode from Shmuel Beis. So the Navi here tells the story. This is in the aftermath of the episode with Bathsheba. So David HaMelech engages in this mistake with Bathsheba. And ultimately in number 9 he's reprimanded by the Navi Nosson. And the Navi Nosson comes along and tells him, "Vayomer David al Nosson, Chatosi LaHashem." So David HaMelech does incredible tshuva, and he does heartfelt, meaningful, sincere tshuva. And the Navi tells David HaMelech, "It's okay. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has forgiven you, but the child that you had with Bathsheba, the child's gonna die. The child's gonna die. That's your punishment from the Ribono Shel Olam. One of your punishments from the Ribono Shel Olam. The child's gonna die." So the Navi goes in. It's a very dramatic episode in number 9. So the Navi records. The Navi says, if you look in Pasuk Tes Zayin, Pasuk 16, "Va'ivakish David es Elokim ba'ad hanar." So David HaMelech begins. So the Navi leaves, handing down this sentence, and David HaMelech begins to fervently pray. "Va'yotzam David tzom." David begins to fast. "Ubavalan v'shachav arzo." He was laying on the ground. He wouldn't eat. He wouldn't sit on a chair. He's just in a state of prostration. And the Navi goes on to say, his servants tried to get him up. King, you have to eat. Right, you have to put yourself together. You're the king, and David is totally nothing. He's only going to daven for the child. The Navi goes on. It says in Pasuk Yud Ches 18, "Vayhi bayom ashvi, vayomas hayelet." Seventh day after the Navi came, child dies. The servants, say the Navi, don't know what to do, because if David HaMelech was such a mess, such a wreck while the child was sick, what is going to happen to him when they tell him that the child has died? So what do they do? Nobody tells him. So they're whispering amongst themselves. David HaMelech is a perceptive man, and when he sees all the whispering, he realizes something happened. So in Pasuk, Yotas, "Vayar David ki avadav mislach Hashim." David saw that his servants were whispering. "Vayoven David ki meis hayeled." And David realized that the child had died. "Vayomer David al avadav hameis hayeled." And David asks the question straight out, "Has the child died?" "Vayomru meis." And the servants say, "Yes, the child has died." Look at number 10. So the Navi goes on. "Vayokam David meha'aretz." David gets up. This is going to sound very strange. "Vayirchatz." He washes himself. "Vayosach." He smears. He anoints himself with oil. "Vayachalif simlosav." He changed his clothing. "Vayavo beis Hashem vayishtachavu." "Vayavo el beisol vayisha vayasmu loyechem vayochel." So David HaMelech just hears that his son has just died. And what does he do? He gets up, takes a shower, smears some oil, changes his clothing, comes to the dining room and asks for the food to be brought out. At this point in time, the servants, normally when the king does things, it's a good idea not to question the king too much. But this, the sermons can't contain us. This behavior is counterintuitive. When the child is alive, you won't eat nothing. And now the child is dead, and suddenly you act like everything is normal. So look what David HaMelech writes in Pasuk Chaf Beis, number 10, verse 22. Vayomer ba'od hayalad chayt samti ve'efke, ki amarti mi yodea v'chaneni Hashem v'chay hayalad. So David says, you don't understand. When the child was alive, I dived into HaKadosh Baruch Hu because I thought maybe I have the ability to change the circumstances. Because maybe, even though the Navi said the child's going to die, the truth is we have another klal in Judaism. The other klal in Judaism is, afilu cheref chada munachas al savaro shel adam, even if there's a sharp sword resting against the neck of an individual, al yimana atzal min arachamim. We never stop trying. We never stop supplicating. We never give up hope until when? Until there is no hope to be had. And even then, we just kind of reconfigure our hope. So David HaMelech says, when the child was alive, so I put all my koach into hoping that I could secure a different outcome. Va'atomis, the child's dead. Ve'lama ze'anitzam, what good is it for me to fast? Ha'ucha la'hashiva od, can I bring him back? And here David HaMelech says something so heartbreaking. Ani holech elav, v'hu lo yashuv elai. I'll see my son, but I'll see him when I go to him. He will never come back to me. And this is such a profound exchange. Because what David HaMelech is teaching us is an incredible yesod. That in life, one has to learn to accept their new realities. One has to learn to accept the circumstances of life, even though these are not the circumstances I want. Even though these are not the circumstances I planned for, if these are the circumstances of my existence, I must accept them. I'm going to flesh this out a little bit more, but let me show you one more episode. Very dramatic in number 11. I actually quoted this on the last day of Pesach, before Yisker. This is an incredible medrash. And what's incredible about this medrash is it's about the man by the name of Rabbi Meir. And Rabbi Meir was the student of Rabbi Akiva, right? Rabbi Meir, you just saw before, was one of the new five. So I think it's very dramatic that we're going to see that the Talmud absorbed the lessons of the Rebbe. Look at number 11, and this is another profound episode. Amru Maisa Haya. There was an episode of Rabbi Meir. Shayoshev Dorsha Beis HaMedrash B'Shabbos B'Mincha. So Rabbi Meir was once in the Beis HaMedrash by Shabbos afternoon, and something happened, but Umesu Shnei Banov. Rabbi Meir had two sons, and on that Shabbos afternoon, both of his sons died. Ma Asa Sa'iman, what did their mother do, Rabbi Meir's wife? Henicha Shnehem Alamita, Upersa Sadin Alehem. So the mother picked up her beloved sons, put them on the bed, and covered their bodies with a sheet. B'motzai Shabbos bar Rabbi Meir b'beis hamedrash l'beiso. Motzai Shabbos Rabbi Meir comes back home. Amar lo, heichan shnei bonai. He asks his wife, have you seen the boys? Where are my sons? Amar lo b'beis hamedrash halachu. So his wife said to him, oh, they're in the b'beis hamedrash. We'll see why she did this. They're in the b'beis hamedrash. Amar lo, tzipisi l'beis hamedrash v'lo ra'isi osam. He said, that's strange. I was just in the b'beis hamedrash. I was in the Beis Medrash the whole afternoon and I didn't see them. So she changes the subject. She gives him a cup of wine for Abdullah, he makes Abdullah. After Abdullah, again he asks, where are my sons? So she says to him, they went to a faraway place, but they're going to come back soon. She brought out Malava Malka. He washed, he ate, he benched. La'achar she'berach amru lo Rebbe, she'ela achas yesh li l'shalacha. Amru lo, imri she'la seich. So his wife says to him, Rabbi Meir, I have a question for you. And he says, please, by all means, ask. And she goes on to explain, here's her question. Her question is, earlier in the day, a person came, and they asked me to watch a particular item. They deposited a particular item with me. And they asked me to watch it to be a shomeris. And now they came back and they want the item back. Do I have to give the item back to the owner or not? So what happens? Amrullah biti, mishish pikadom etzlo hutzarach lachzir l'rabo. I'm now 2, 4, 6 lines up from where it ends. So Rav Meir says, of course, if somebody deposits an item with you for safekeeping, but it's their item, when they come back, you have to give it back to them. Listen to this. Amrullah Rebbe Chutzmi Da'atech Lo Ayisi No Senes Etzlo. such a heartbreaking medrash. She says, you know, my husband, she calls him Rebbe, she says, my husband, were it not that you said that, I would not have returned the object. Ma'asasa, what did she do? Tafasto biyada. She took her husband's hand. Ve'ha'ala oso la'osa cheder. And she took him into the room where the bodies of the boys were lying. Ve'griva oso lamita. She brought him close to the bed. Ve'natla sadin me'aleim. And she drew the sheet back. Ve'ra'u shnehem mesim umunachim alamita. Rabbi Meir sees his two beloved sons lifeless on the bed. Hischil bocha ve'omer bonai bonai Rebbe, Rebbe, my sons, my teachers. And he goes on to say, they were my sons b'derech eretz. In biology, they were my children. Ve'Rebbe v'shayu me'irin ponai b'torasim. But they were my teachers because they taught me so much in Torah. Ba'osa sha'a amru lo Rabbi Meir. Rebbe, lo kach amarti li. So his wife says to him, she said, my teacher, my Rebbe, my husband, did you not just tell me that when the owner of the object comes and asks for the object back, that you have to return it? Amar, at that point, Rabbi Meir says, Hashem nasan, v'Hashem lakach, yihi shem Hashem evorach. Hashem is given, Hashem is taken. The name of Hashem should be blessed. Amar Rabbi Chanina, b'davar hazeh nichamtu v'nesiyash v'odato l'kach ne'emar eishes chayil miyimtza. So what's amazing about this medrash is the following. What happens? What does Rabbi Meir do? Rabbi Meir simply takes the lessons of his Rebbe. The greatness, let's bring this together. What's happening, what does David HaMelech do? David HaMelech accepts his new reality. Right? So David HaMelech realizes there's a choice in life. In life, sometimes one of the most difficult and dramatic moments, actually, look at number 12 first, before I tell you this. There's an amazing medrash. The medrash says, on the pasuk in Koheles, quoted by the Gemara, Baboker zara es zarecha, ula'arev al tanach yadecha, in the morning, go ahead and seed your seed, and in the evening, don't withdraw your hand. So look how the medrash understands this pasuk. His halich bitumecha. Walk bitumecha. What does tumecha mean? Tumecha, what word does that sound like? Tamim. What does tamim mean? Good, okay. All correct. We'll see what it means in just a moment. His halich bitumecha. I'm sorry? Good. Hold it for a second. His halich bitumecha. Walk with timimus. Walk. We'll see what that means in just a moment. Vitsei lizria. Vitzei liktzira. Walk with God as a tamim, and go out to plant, and go out to reap. What does that mean? So we have the word tamim. In number 13, the Torah in Dvarim says, tamim tiyam Hashem Elokecha. Be a tamim with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What does it mean to be a tamim? All right, complete, simple, perfect, pure. Look what Rashi HaKadosh says in number 14. Ela kol ma sheyavo alecha, kabel bitamimus. You know what tamimus means? To be tamim, to be complete with God, means to be accepting of your life circumstances. If there's one thing that is almost an unavoidable truth in life, it's that life never works out according to plan. The way you think it's going to happen is generally not the way that it happens. And sometimes that departure from plan is very dramatic, and sometimes it's just nuanced. But more often, I'm saying, even if we, sometimes it's a little bit of a depressing episode, but when we look back at our lives, if we look back what we wanted when we were 20, when we were 30, when we were 40, when we were 50, so the truth is, and where we are now, more often than not, all of us walk around with some unfulfilled piece of life. It's just and sometimes it's our fault. Sometimes it's just because of circumstances beyond my control. So what do you do when life doesn't go according to plan? See, you have a choice. You could spend all of your energies rallying against how unfair life is. You can say zelo fair in every single language you know. You can go ahead and you could wag your finger and have it saying, Ribono shel olam, I deserve better. You know me, I tried, I did everything right. How can you let this happen to me? Accuse God, blast God, be angry at God, be angry at myself. We could do that. And many people do that. Many people use all of their energy lamenting their circumstances. And you know where it gets them? absolutely nowhere. Because no matter how much you cry, no matter how sorry you feel for yourself, no matter how much you point that finger heavenward about why it's not fair that my life is like this, guess what? It's not going to change one iota of your life circumstances. There's an amazing halacha in Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says in this, halacha always bothered me, I'm going to be honest, until, of course, it's halacha, so it doesn't matter if it bothers me or not, it's halacha, but it bothered me just from a philosophical perspective. This halacha in Shulchan Aruch says like this, when a person is sitting Shiva, Rachman al-Tan, a person loses a loved one, they're not allowed to say, if I could change these circumstances, I would. If I could bring back, I would do anything to bring back my loved one. You're not allowed to say those words as paskin in the Shulchan Aruch. Why not? Why not? Because you can't. Because what's the point of investing your emotional energy into a process that will never actualize? What is the point of using all of your emotional resources to conjure up some alternate reality of bringing back a loved one that is not going to occur? As David HaMelech says, Ani holeich elav, v'hu lo yashuv elai. So the halacha says, everyone has a limited pool of emotional koach. Use it well. If you use it in an outlet that is not going to yield any fruit, it's a frustrating experience. Because you're going to imagine this life where you bring back your loved one, and then what? And what do you have to show for it? Nothing more than a vivid imagination. Go back to Ramatov for just a moment. Listen to this. What does it mean? In the morning, go out, sow your seeds, and in the evening, don't stop. It means that no matter what life throws your way, keep going. It didn't work out the way you wanted it. It's sad. It is sad. And sometimes it's exceptionally heartbreaking when our life plans don't materialize. But there's a choice. There's a choice. I could put away the farming tools, close up the shed and go back home and let the field lay fallow. Or I could choose to go ahead and continue to plant. The first plans didn't come out the way that I wanted it to. So will I lament that, spending my life lamenting the fallen, the failed crop? Or will I have the courage to go out and plant a little bit more? That's what Rabbi Meir is doing also. Rabbi Meir sees his two sons, you know, the loss of a child. The loss of a child, Rachmana Litzlan, is so much more than the loss of someone you love. The loss of a child is the loss of a future. Right, our children represent, our children are the extension of, Hirsch says, that part of the almost innate desire that people have to have children, he says, is based on a desire for immortality. Everybody wants to live forever, but none of us are going to live forever. So how do we secure some degree of immortality? Through our children. Because ultimately, in Yeretz Hashem, if a person is blessed with children, it means that even when I'm gone, a part of me will continue on. So when I lose a child, not only am I losing someone who I love who's an extension of me, what it's done is also is it's taken away from my life. My own mortality, my immortality has been taken from me, and my own mortality has just become so pronounced. Rabbi Meir sees his two sons, he only had two children. He saw his two sons lifeless on the bed in front of him, and he has a choice, and he begins to fall into that abyss. He begins to cry out, Rabbi, Rabbi, Bonai, Bonai, and what does his wife do? She takes his hand and she says, remember, you have to give back to the creditor what belongs to him. And what does he do? He composes himself, Hashem Nasan, Hashem Lakach, Yehi Shem Hashem Mevorach. It doesn't mean that everything is okay. And it doesn't mean that there's no pain. And it doesn't mean that the scars of unfulfilled dreams and unfulfilled life ever heal. Many of us walk around with those gaping wounds throughout life. But in life, the fundamental question is, do you spend your energy lamenting your circumstances? Or do you put your koach into accepting those circumstances and figuring out how to build from them? I think this is answer number one as to why there is no response from Rabbi. There's no response from Rabbi Akiva. Because what is Rabbi Akiva going to say? What is he going to do? There's an existential threat to the Jewish people. So I have a choice. I could lament, and I'm sure Rabbi Akiva was a great Isha Chesed. Rabbi Akiva was the one who always tried to find, you know, the silver lining in every situation. What do you say to 24,000 widows? Why do you say that 24,000 children without a father? What's the silver lining in that? And the answer is, there is none. The answer is there is none. So Rabbi Akiva says, I have a choice. I can go ahead and lament this. I could cry about it. Or what I need to do is rebuild Klal Yisrael. So he goes from 24,000 Talmidim, and he gathers up five more in the south of the country, and he says, Maranan v'Rabbanan, it's time to rebuild. I accept these circumstances for what they are. They're not of my choosing. Never in a million years did I ever think that life was going to go down this direction. But sometimes our circumstances, we don't choose our circumstances. Our circumstances choose us. And so now, this is my life. This is my chilek. I have to now figure out how to do something constructive. No response. Because sometimes the way to deal with unexpected circumstances in life is not through words, but first through acceptance, and then through a commitment to plant again. It's only if you accept the reality that the first crops did not survive that you'll have the strength to plant again. Another idea. Take a look at number 15. There's an amazing Meiri, the Beis HaBechira, and I included for you over here a little biography. The Meiri is from Menachem Ben Shlomo Meiri, born in 1249, dies in 1315, southern France. So the Meiri does something amazing. The Meiri writes, Lama, to say, quotes the Gemara, Lama Torah Bialduso, Hayul Talmidim Bialduso, Yelaz Viziknuso. Okay. Now, so what Rabbi Akiva say? If you learn Torah in your youth, learn Torah when you're old. If you had students in your youth, establish students in your old age. Why? Look at this underlined line. Shepamim, Shaosim Bialduso Mesim. You know why? Because even if you have students in your young age, you still have to have students in your older age. Why? Because sometimes the students that you established earlier die, as happened to Rabbi Akiva. Uboim osim shebiziknuso. But then you'll have new students in your old age. Umashlimin. Mashlimin means what? Mashlimin means, and they will complete you. They will complete you. So it's interesting. Because why does the Meiri have to use, what does that mean? They will. I understand, meaning, even if you would have left off that word, I understand the message. The message is, like we just said before, you have to always plant. You have to always plant, because again, the great uncertainty of life is you never know what's going to endure. You never know what's going to keep. You never know what's going to last. And therefore, Shlomo HaMelech essentially tells us that just keep doing. And if you keep doing, the statistical probability is what? Something will last. But the Meiri adds in that extra word. Because sometimes the students of your youth die, and you'll go and you'll educate new ones in your older years. Umashliman. And those students will complete you. So what's the pshat? So I think to appreciate this umashliman, take a look at number 16. In Devarim, the Torah speaks about the mitzvah of Amalek, of Zechiras Amalek. So the Torah tells us in number 16, Zochor es asher asalacha Amalek. Remember what Amalek did to you, did to us when we left Egypt. They happened upon you on the road. Where did Amalek attack? Amalek attacked the stragglers, right? The weak and the old. In the back of the camp, who were straggling behind. And when HaKadosh Baruch Hu settles you in Eretz Yisrael and gives you the land, Timcha as Zechra Amalek, you have to wipe out the memory of Amalek, mitachasash underneath the heavens, lo tishkach, don't forget. What's the obvious question? Why do I need the two phrases? If you're already telling me Zachar, remember, then what does that automatically tell me? Don't forget. And if you're going to tell me don't forget, then you don't have to tell me, you know, this sounds like a conversation with your parents, you know, right? Remember and don't forget, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu, give us a little bit more credit. If you tell me to remember, I got it, I'm going to remember. And therefore, why the need for Zachar and Lo Tishkach? Why remembrance and don't forget? I want to share with you something absolutely amazing. Take a look at number 17. The other question, by the way, in this is not only why the double lashon, but the more fundamental question, which is, what is it exactly that we are supposed to remember about Amalek? So, simple answer is, we're supposed to remember that they attacked us. Okay, that could be it. But is there something deeper that's being asked of us? Take a look at number 17. So this is from a sefer, Shalos Teshuvos B'Ma'amakim. So this Shalos Teshuvos was written by Rav Oshri, Rav Ephraim Oshri Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Rav Oshri was the Rav of the Kovna Ghetto. Now, there was no official, that was not an official position, it was a de facto position. Sakovna, we know, before the war, for a while before the war, was a major center of Jewish thought, of Talmud Torah. Great Gidolim lived there throughout the ages. And at the onset of the war, the greatest Torah luminary in Kovna was a man by the name of Rav Elchanan Wasserman, Hashem Yikom Domo. Rav Elchanan Wasserman was the gadol of Kovno, and when the Nazis, Machshavah Zichron, rounded up the Jews into the Kovno ghetto, so the Jews kicked them for shilas. People were still asking questions, even during the Holocaust. Rav Elchanan Wasserman, Hashem Yikom Domo, was murdered by the Lithuanians at the Ninth Fort. The Ninth Fort was an area right outside of the Kovno ghetto. When Rav Elchanan Wasserman was murdered, so the responsibility of shepherding the Jewish people fell upon Rav Ashri. You know, I'll tell you something interesting, that I had this chus to meet Rav Ashri once. So before I tell you this piece, Rav Ashri recorded his shilas, so people came to ask him all kinds of questions during the war, immediately after the war. Rav Ashri began to record the questions. Rav Ashri did not think he was going to survive the war, but he wanted there to be a testament to the spiritual will of the Jewish people. So what did he do? He wrote down the Shalos HaTshuvos, and he buried it in a canister in the Kovno ghetto. And he told a number of people where he buried it, figuring he's not going to survive. And after the war, somebody will come up and dig it up. A similar thing happened with the Ish Kodesh. The Rebbe Piazhetsna, Rav Klonimus Kalman Shapir, did the same thing. Unfortunately, the Piazhetsna was murdered by the Nazis, Yimach Shemo B'Zichron, but the same idea. He wrote down the drushas, buried them in a canister. So after the war, Rav Ashri Baruch Hashem survives, unearths the canister. Now you have to understand something, that when the Jews came to ask him these shilas, and to read these shilas is, you know, here, what we do in the shul over here on Tisha B'Av often is we do a number of these shilas throughout the morning. To read these shilas themselves is just, I don't even know how to describe it. The questions that came to him were just mind-blowing. So he said that what he wanted to do after the war is, I'm sorry, so during the war, when he answered them, he didn't have access to Sfarim, didn't have access to books, right? So where he was an incredible Talmud Chacham, so he answered them from memory, whatever little Sfarim he had. After the war, he went back, and he wrote a formal Shalos and Shuvas. He wrote down with footnotes, with sources and everything. It's a 6-volume series called Shalos and Shuvas Mi Ma'amaki, Responsa from the Depths. In English, it's actually put out. They put it out in a 1-volume called Responsa from the Holocaust, written by Rashi. You can still purchase. Unfortunately, the Hebrew is out of print now, but the English you can still get. And in each, so I was saying, I had this chus to meet Rav Ashri one time on an Erev Pesach. I went to sell my chametz with him. I didn't really need to sell my chametz with him. I just wanted an excuse to meet him. So you know how in your mind, when you hear about great people, you develop this image in your mind's eye about how they're going to look. So you think about Rav Ashri, a man who went ahead and literally shouldered the Jewish people on his shoulders during those terribly dark and barbaric years. You expect to see someone strapping, gallant. I opened up the door. He opened up the door, and at first I didn't even see him because I don't think he was 4.5 feet. I don't think he was 4.5 feet. And it was so amazing how a man so small in stature was such an incredible gadol for Yisrael. And so if there's anyone here from New York, Rav Ashri was from Lower East Side. Rav Ashri was the Rav of the Beis Medrash HaGadol on the Lower East Side. So Rav Ashri writes, so in each of the 6 volumes, the Shalos HaTshuvos Ma'amakim, so Rav Ashri writes an introduction. And in his introduction to the 3rd section of his Shalos HaTshuvos, he discusses this question. And he asks, he says, why does the Torah need to tell us, Zachar, remember, and Lo Tishkach? See, he writes, now again, what Rav Ashri does, and this is so personally powerful and painful, Rav Ashri just simply translates Amalek into Nazis, Yimach Shemam B'Zichram. He says that for our generation to remember Amalek, he's talking to his generation, the survivors, of course we remember Amalek. Right? Does the Torah need to tell us to remember Amalek? And he goes on, we can't do all of it just because of time, but I put it on the sheet in paragraph 8, he says, how can we not remember Amalek? Right? We have Auschwitz forever embedded on our arms. How can we forget? And he goes through all the, how can we forget about Dachau and Treblinka and Mauthausen and the forced, how can, of course, Zachar, you don't have to tell me to remember. I live it still. So many of us are still there each and every day, despite the fact that we've been emancipated for years. And he goes on, look at paragraph 8, paragraph 6. See, turn to page 5. See, he writes, Torah shezachar niskor is asher asa lanu Amalek. So Rav Ashri writes, the Torah does not word, we will always remember that which Amalek did to us. How could we not remember that which the German beast did to us? Ulam haTorah mutza linchot lahosef lanu tzivui nosaf. So Rav Ashi makes an incredible idea. Rav Ashi says, look at the pasuk for a second. The pasuk begins by saying, remember what Amalek did to you when you left Egypt, that they attacked you. Then what does the Torah say? And it will, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will settle you in Eretz Yisrael, and you'll have a land, and you'll have a life. What does the Torah tell us? Lo tishkach, don't forget. And Rav Ashi says something amazing. Rav Ashi speaks to his fellow survivors, and he says, you know, now we live our pain. Now, ultimately, not a day goes by that we don't think about our experiences. We live in a constant state of zachar. But there's going to come a time when we're going to want to rebuild. And he's right. He says, we're going to want to establish families. And we're going to want to establish homes. And we're going to be captains of industry. And we're going to be successful in all different areas of life. And Rav Ashi says, you know what we're going to think? We're going to think that in order to be successful, we have to let go of our pain. Then in order to be successful, we have to disassociate from, because you're going to think that your pain is like a ball and chain. Okay, good. Like a weight around my foot that's dragging me down into this abysmal abyss of pain and suffering, that your pain is holding you back. And you're going to think that in order to grow as a person, you have to disassociate from your pain. Leave your pain behind. Get over it. It's the past. And what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu say? No. Lo tishkach. The Jew never forgets his or her pain. The Jew, says Rav Ashi, does something different. The Jew doesn't forget their pain. The Jew learns the art of owning their pain. What does that mean? Let's go back to Amalek for just a moment. Rav Ashi says something so profound. If you think about this idea, why do we remember Amalek? Like for us, 2013. So right, every year, Shabbos before Purim, we read Parsha Zachar, we even take out the Torah 15 million times in case somebody came late, this one wasn't Kiddush. So right, why? Why? At the end of the day, okay, I heard it, wonderful. Now what? What does that do for me? You know what it does for me, my friends? I'll tell you. Where did Amalek attack? Ha-nechesh shalom acharecha. You know why we remember Amalek? You know why we remember them? Because we give ourselves Musar. How did we allow for nechesh shalom acharecha? How did we allow for stragglers? How did we allow for the old and infirm to be left behind? What? It's enough? If I'm here, my wife is here, my kids are here, my friends are here, okay, let's go. What about the people who can't keep up? How did we become so self-centered and egocentric that we didn't pay attention to the less fortunate? That's what we remember. So says Rav Ashi, own your pain. Of course, we always have to remember what Amalek did to us. Why? Because by remembering what Amalek did to us, that forges my personality. By remembering what Amalek did to us, that makes me into a more sensitive individual. Because every single year, you know what we have built into the Jewish psyche? On Parshas Zach, you know what we're supposed to do? Look around and make sure no Jew is left behind. Make sure there are no nechesh shalom acharecha. Make sure that we don't forget about those who perhaps are not like everyone else. Make sure we don't forget about those who perhaps can't keep up with everyone else. Another idea, you know, this is a fascinating concept. If I offend you or I hurt you, I mean, I wouldn't do it, chas v'shalom, but if Reuven, right? So I get offended by someone or someone hurts me. So it's interesting that what does the Torah tell me I'm supposed to do with that pain? What doesn't the Torah tell me? If you look, it's interesting. Well, what can't I do? Lo siko v'lo sitor, right? I'm not allowed to go ahead and take revenge, right? That's nekama. Lo sitor means I can't like find a way to give you a shtach about it. Lo sisna esachicha b'lavavecha. I can't hate you in my heart. Does the Torah ever tell us that we have to forget our pain? Never. You know why? Because you're not supposed to forget your pain. You know why? The pain of getting hurt by someone is very important. Because when you feel the pain of getting hurt from someone, that makes you into a more sensitive person. If you've been on the receiving end of pain, and you know what that searing feeling of being abused feels like, you don't want to get rid of that. You want to own that. Because that pain will refine your interactions with others. What Rav Ashri is saying is, this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is teaching us. Yes, Zachar means to remember. That's true. But you know what happens? There are going to be times in life where you're going to think that in order to grow, you have to forget about your pain. No. Lo tishkach. Never forget your pain. Own your pain. When you own your pain, what you say is, yes, it hurts. And yes, the events of my life sometimes leave me with an incredible searing pain that never goes away. But the question is now, this is part of me. So the question now is, what do I do with it? How can I take this pain and somehow transform it into something positively cathartic? With Amalek, we take the yearly pain of Amalek and we use it to make ourselves sensitive to those who lag behind. With the Holocaust of Auschwitz, we're saying a number of different things. When somebody hurts me, I keep the pain in order to remind myself, ultimately, how to treat others. I know what it feels like when somebody offends me, when somebody hurts me, when somebody abuses me. So when I interact with you, you are going to be the beneficiary of my pain, because my pain is going to transform me, hopefully, into a more sensitive individual. We take every tragic and difficult event and we have to try to figure out what to do with it. What does this teach me about myself? What does this teach me about my life? And how will I use this to somehow affect and impact how I live? The pain doesn't go away, but suddenly the individual is using the pain as an incredible springboard for growth. And now we understand something amazing. In truth, if you look at number 18, we actually just did this in our Tehillim share. This is by Rav Soloveitchik. In the pasuk in number 18, David HaMelech writes, Keli, Keli, lama azavtani? My God, why have you forsaken me? And all of the Mefarshim ask the same basic question, which is, that how could David HaMelech be asking this question? David HaMelech is asking the question of, why do bad things happen to good people? Why am I suffering? So the Rav says, Rav Soloveitchik writes, that there's no way that David HaMelech is asking lama. What is David HaMelech asking? Lima. Lima. For what? I'm in pain. I'm hurting. I've been hurt by you, God. I've been hurt by my fellow man. Lima. Okay, now tell me what I'm going to remember it. It's part of me. And I know that I can't forget it because somehow I have to own this pain. Lima. What am I supposed to do with it? And this is the pshat and the Me'iri. Go back for just a moment. Remember that Me'iri? Of course you remember the Me'iri. The Me'iri was in number 15. Remember the Me'iri added in one word. What word did the Me'iri add in? Mashlimin, very good. Mashlimin. So what happens? The Me'iri writes that sometimes you have students in your youth, those students will die, and what happens? You'll have new students, mashlimin, and they will complete. You know what the Me'iri? I think what the Me'iri is saying is that sometimes it's the pain in life that's mashlim me. I'm only the person who I am because of my good experiences and because of my painful experiences. My personality is forged by my pain. My pain completes who I am. It's not pleasant. It's not how we want our personality to be forged. It's not how we want our identity to be developed. But the Me'iri says, it's a fact of life. Sometimes you build and you lose, and when you rebuild, and when rebuilding means owning your pain, umashliman, it's only by going through that you become a whole person. It's only by experiencing the pain that you really become a full shalim. You know why Rabbi Akiva doesn't answer? You know why there's no response recorded in the Gemara? Because Rabbi Akiva understands that as difficult and as tragic as this situation is, it's a necessary part for his personal, individual, spiritual maturation. Rabbi Akiva chooses to own his pain. What am I going to do with this situation? And by the way, you know what Rabbi Akiva does do? Well, we'll get to what Rabbi Akiva does do in just a moment. So now what we've done is, so far, we've seen exactly why it is that we're mourning, right? So we understand now it's not, well, I'm sorry. I'm trying to get too much in at once. Let's skip for a moment to our second question. Why do we celebrate on Lag BaOmer? Right? Why do we celebrate Lag BaOmer? So look at number 19. So the simple answer is that, again, so remember what we have so far. We have now this morning during the course of Sirah, Rabbi Akiva's students have died. There is no response recorded in the Gemara. A, because Rabbi Akiva realizes there's no response necessary. Right now, I have a twofold mandate. Number one, accept my circumstances. This is my new. This is the new circumstance. There's no point in expending any emotional energy lamenting it. I have to figure out how to navigate it. The first crop top died, and it died horribly. I have to figure out now how I'm going to replant. And number two, there's no response. Why? Because Rabbi Akiva takes the position of owning his pain. Rabbi Akiva is not just simply a Zachar Jew. Rabbi Akiva is a Lo Tishkach Jew. This pain is mashlim me. So now I have to figure out what to do with it. What does Rabbi Akiva do with it? So now this is going to come to our second question. We celebrate on Lag BaOmer. So why do we celebrate on Lag BaOmer? So the classic answer is, or I should say, Marbim Kitzas Simcha, a little bit of Simcha on Lag BaOmer. So the Beis HaVechira writes something amazing. The Meiri again, he says, V'kabola v'yad ge'onim, shebiyom lamed gimel BaOmer, paska ha-misa, v'noagi mitoch kach, sholis anos. So the Beis HaVechira says, oh, you know why we celebrate on Lag BaOmer? Because the students of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying. Now, I'll tell you the truth. I'm sure, like many of you, I've always found this answer to be exceptionally bizarre. Right? Meaning, okay, good, mazel tov, the students stopped dying. Right? Okay, let's have a little, make a bonfire, make a little barbecue. You know, it's strange. It's strange. Meaning, I understand if you want to say that the mourning practices cease on Lag BaOmer because the students stopped dying. I understand that, right? We're in a state of active mourning while they're dying. Lag BaOmer, they stop dying, stop the mourning practices. But it's a far cry from cessation of mourning practices to actually engaging in simcha. So because they stopped dying, we engage in simcha. Look at number 20. There's an amazing medrash. The medrash records the story of the Gemara virtually verbatim. There are a couple of changes in the Medrash number 20. Rabbi Akiva doesn't have 12,000 pairs, rather he only has 12,000 students in total. And also, according to this Medrash, he reestablishes 7 students instead of 5 students. That's fine, but look at the first 2 lines. Rabbi Akiva Omer Shtimasar Alofim Talmidim Hayuli. I have 12,000 students. Migvas Adan Tipras. Vikulan Mesu Bein Pesach La'atzeres. And they all died between Pesach and Shavuos. Ubasof Yomim Elu. Ha'amidu li shiva. Now, what does that phrase mean? Ubesof yomim elu. Ubesof yomim elu. At the end of these days referring to what? The days that his students were dying. After my students stopped dying, then what? Ha'amidu li shiva. I went and established 7 new students. You know what the Medrash is saying? That same day. You know what happened? On the day that Rabbi Akiva's students stopped dying, Lag BaOmer, what does Rabbi Akiva do? Rabbi Akiva goes to the south of Eretz Yisrael and finds for himself new Talmidim. Basof Yomim Elu. So when they finished dying, when they literally finished dying that day, after Rabbi Akiva finishes filling in the last grave, he goes from there to replant and to find new Talmidim. Amazingly enough, where does Rabbi Akiva find the courage to rebuild? Where does Rabbi Akiva find the courage to replant after the first crop has been so abysmally destroyed? Again, number one, because Rabbi Akiva understands that there's no point in lamenting what didn't happen. Accept the new reality, because this is what it is, and use my emotional energy towards replanting. And number two, I'm not going to lament these circumstances. I'm not going to lament the pain. I'm going to own the pain. Some way, somehow, these circumstances will make me who I am. And you know what happens when you take that approach to life? The amazing part is you have the incredible courage, resolve, and strength to rebuild. Rabbi Akiva goes on that very day when the students stopped dying to go and reestablish a new next generation for Klal Yisrael. And that's the Kitzas Simcha of Lag BaOmer. The Simcha of Lag BaOmer is not the cessation of death. That's not a cause for Simcha. That might be a cause for relief, but not a cause for Simcha. The Kitzas Simcha of Lag BaOmer, the little bit of extra Simcha we have on Lag BaOmer, ultimately is the Simcha of the triumph of the human spirit. That no matter how badly things turn out, no matter how much my reality differs from what I thought it was going to be, if I exercise Rabbi Akiva-like courage, I too can rebuild. My friends, when you rebuild, do you get exactly what you had before? No. Rabbi Akiva never got back 24,000 students. In fact, the last thing you know is he had 7 students. So often in life, when we have to rebuild, we can't put up the same edifice we had before. We can't necessarily recreate how life was before. But that's part of the acceptance. Part of the acceptance is that even when I find the courage to rebuild, maybe it's not going to be as beautiful. Maybe it won't be as shiny or as sparkly or as exciting. but it could still be something absolutely magnificent. So if we bring this all together, I think we see expressed in the halacha something absolutely amazing. You know, we come out of Pesach, and after Pesach, on Pesach itself, we go ahead and we celebrate our newfound freedom. And we very quickly realize that freedom comes with an awesome amount of responsibility. And freedom requires an incredible amount of courage. So what happens? We're not simply mourning the loss of the students of Rabbi Akiva. What we're mourning is in our first moments of freedom, because remember, when does the Omer begin? The Omer begins second day Pesach, it's already on Yom Tov itself. Already in our first moments of freedom, that we mourn the fact that losses are part of the fabric of the human condition. And when I say losses, I don't mean death necessarily. I don't mean loss of a loved one. I mean more loss of a dream. That at the end of the day, if there's one certainty in life, it is not all of your dreams will materialize. It's only in Disney where all of your dreams come true. Outside of Disney, it does not happen. And outside of Disney, which is the real world, ultimately, more often than not, there will always be some dreams that are dashed, always be some dreams that don't come, even get off the ground, and always be some dreams that begin to materialize, but then go up in a horrific ball of smoke. That is part of the fabric of the human condition. The things that we plant often do not endure. But we learn an incredible lesson from Rabbi Akiva. Number one, to find the courage to accept your new reality. And number two, own your pain. And in doing so, allow it to be mashlim you. This is like the way we started this year. We don't mourn as an ends. We mourn as a means. We use the death of Rabbi Akiva students to teach us how to be complete people. Again, by accepting our reality and by owning our pain and realizing that even the most turbulent of life circumstances complete my persona. And we should hope that Amir Tashem in the Zocha following this model of Rabbi Akiva, because the truth is in life, we all have our Rabbi Akiva moments. Not as dramatic as Rabbi Akiva's, but we all have those moments when ultimately what we thought was going to be does not exactly materialize. But we take our cue from Rabbi Akiva in these two distinct steps, and halavai, we should be zocha that Amir Tzashem, if we follow in the model of Rabbi Akiva, that we too will be zocha to our Lag BaOmer, that Amir Tzashem, we will also be zocha to rejoice in the newfound resilience of our spirit, and the newfound resilience of our life resolve. All right.